shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Bedtime turns me off and I don't need maybe.
720 WGN, Dane Neal in the Allstate Showcase studio here for the Nocturnal Journal. And Dave Hoekstra fans, fear not. Dave is going to be front and center with so much of what you love about what he does in this program. I'm going to have some things. We're going to have Tyler Florence, the great chef from California, Food Network star. Chef Jacques Pepin is going to be on with us as well. Sarah Moulton has got a new book. She'll be on with us. And PR and hospitality superstar giving us the best wines and cocktails for the summer, Christine Doyson. Will also be with us. And but the city is alive. I mean, it is amazing. Michigan Avenue is teeming with people. So much great stuff going on. So much food, of course, and so much music going on in the area. Summerfest is in full swing. Naperville Rib Fest usually has some pretty good acts. Taste of Chicago is around the corner. And some great music is happening out at Fitzgerald's for the American Music Fest. And on the line with us, we have the man, the myth, the legend himself, Dave Hoekstra. Dave, you guys are out there, right?
Sitting in a camper van, a Ford Transit camper van. Yes, we are.
Now, you know how to have a good time, convey that to the listeners, and travel well.
Yeah, we're doing a book. The next book I'm doing is I'm kind of camper culture and using camping as a metaphor for human interest stories and stuff. So, yeah, I just did about 6,500 miles in about 3 weeks, you know, went in and out of Route 66 up the California coast, up through British Columbia, and then back through Washington and Idaho and Wyoming. So it's been a great trip. So we just got back a couple days ago, and we wanted to bring some musicians from the American Music Festival into the van. See how it sounds.
into the friendly and communicative confines of the van. Got to tell you, though, last week, just absolutely loved the stuff that you did on Merle Haggard, going to some of his haunts, the cafe where he was at. You really kind of brought us to the place he spent so much time.
Well, thank you. And, you know, what I tried to do there was, it was like almost like a personal journey to do the Steinbeck Museum, where we actually got to sit in the Travels with Charlie Van and then the next morning get up and have breakfast at Merle Haggard's favorite place up in Redding. So that was a really memorable part of the trip. But, yeah, it's a 9x20 van. It's, you know, we had it kind of custom made. We've had the guys on the show before who made it. But Dan's here, and nice. We've got Curtis McMurtry. He's going to play some songs. So, yeah, it's nice. And the festival's really, really jumping. It's a beautiful night out here in Berwyn.
Yeah, that is a great facility. It's one of those really awesome music venues that we have where you can see bands in an intimate setting. So let's talk about American Music Fest at Fitzgerald's. What's going on there? What are people experiencing tonight?
Right now there's a group called the Zimmerman. They're playing. We hear them in the background, and they're doing a tribute to Bob Dylan, who's in all kinds of era-type songs. With Robbie Foulkes just sat in. I just saw him a little bit ago with John Fulbright. Then Robbie's doing a solo set himself at 11:15 tonight. Then tomorrow is the last day of the festival. They've got Rico, who's been on Nocturnal Journal. Yeah, they're playing in the afternoon at 2:00. And Toronto Cannon, another Nocturnal Journal veteran, which propelled them to stardom, Dan Long. James McMurtry, who we all know, and Dos Lobos and Reckless Color. Dos Lobos, I should say, is David Hidalgo and Cesar Rojas of Los Lobos. That's going to be quite good.
Wow.
That's at 9:45 tomorrow night. So the last night's always a big blowout here.
Oh, so a lot of stuff for people to experience over the next couple of days out at Fitzgerald. And for the listeners and the fans of Nocturnal Journal, you're going to be doing some recordings, doing some interviews while we're doing the show here. So who are you going to record that people are going to hear next week?
We've got Curtis McMurtry on deck here, and we're going to talk about his music and some of his travels. And then after him, we're going to bring on Bill Fitzgerald wrap up the festival, and then we're also going to talk to John D. Graham, another Austin, Texas-based singer-songwriter, who you know, Curtis. Yeah. So it's going to be a good segment.
We're looking forward to it. I know the fans are looking forward to it as well. We're going to be checking in with you periodically. And 312-981-7200, if fans have a question that they want to ask. We can, next time we talk to Dave, we can definitely pose that to him. And if you've got any thoughts on Fitzgerald's or the great music venues and you want to text in or call in, you can do that as well. 312-981-7200. Okay, Dave, will you get in there, do some of the interviews, enjoy what it is that you're doing, of course, and we'll check in with you a little bit later on in the program.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. That is Dave Hoekstra. It is the Nocturnal Journal. This is going to be an exciting thing. It's a remote broadcast from the van, not just any van, but the remote WGN broadcast Nocturnal Journal van. So stay tuned for that. And of course, the guests that we mentioned that we're going to have on as well. Tyler Florence coming up, Jacques Pepin, cooking and culinary legend. We're going to have Sarah Moulton talking about our new book. And Christine Doyson is going to be coming up right after this break. So stay tuned. It's Dane in for Dave on 720 WGN. I always love the music. Sean Davis in the booth, spinning the hit 720 at WGN. Dane Neal, Allstate Showcase Studio, Michigan Avenue in Chicago, a Chicago that is vibrant and alive with so many great things going on. But you can't know about all the great things. You need somebody there to tell the stories of the great things, get those great things in front of people who can share that with so many people. And in studio, it is a pleasure to have in studio one of the leading figures in food and hospitality PR. She is award-winning. She is the president of Doyson Global, 2016 PR Company of the Year by Drinks Biz Magazine, the one and only Christine Doyson. Christine, welcome to WGN.
Thanks, Dane. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here and in studio. Of course, we've known each other for a very, very long time. And normally you're in New York because you're traveling all around the world at all times. But typically you reside in New York, but here you are in Chicago.
I do. I live in New York City because 80% of the nation's media are based there. So it's important to us to be there. But I'm from Michigan, so I'm here celebrating the 4th of July with my family.
How does, you know, when you have so many things related to the hospitality world, and predominantly it is a positive, fun-filled world, right? It isn't, you know, doom and gloom for the most part. These are good things that people know, enjoy, and love to celebrate with. But how do you celebrate a holiday like the 4th?
Well, we are doing a lot of eating and a lot of drinking, which is normal for my family. So we have lots of wines lined up and lots of barbecue.
Lots of wines and barbecue. That's a recipe for, I think, a great 4th of July weekend. And, of course, you spend time with the family, and you have them all in studio here as well. Your mom is here. Your sister is here. Your boyfriend is here. Is this the typical posse that you travel with?
It's my entourage.
Oh, okay, right. So let's talk about some of the reasons that you are in town. Got to talk with you earlier this week about the wines of the Republic of Georgia, you know, and that is a story that up until now really wasn't being told. And you've done that, you know, whether it's different wines from different regions, whether it's unique spirits, you know, that had never either existed or been presented to America before. That's kind of cool, right?
Yeah, we're very fortunate. So I started my agency in 2002. And we do. We specialize in wines and foods, spirits, hospitality, and travel. And as the owner, I'm able to select the clients that we work on and accept to work on things that I really believe in and really care about. And I think that helps us do our job better, too, because our job is to help our clients become better known. So, indeed, I was just here because for the wines of the Republic of Georgia.
Right. This isn't Atlanta, Georgia. I'm sure there's some great wines there, too. Maybe not.
They're very interesting from the Republic of Georgia. And we did a series of events, and an interview with you, right, and dinners here in Chicago. And it was great. And we also took time to have some fun, try out the local restaurants. Today we just saw Book of Mormon, which was fabulous.
Wow.
So back to work, though. We work with Baijiu, which is Baijiu is to China what Scotch is to Scotland. It's actually the biggest spirit category in the world, although people from the West have barely heard of it.
Baijiu. I have not, I have heard a little bit about, you know, China as they kind of emerge from into more of a capitalist society. You know, they're trying to enjoy all the things that we've enjoyed. And so they have kind of tapped in and affected the supplies of wines and spirits and other things. But so this is great. I'm learning something. Baijiu. So everybody drinks. It's a spirit like, is it like Scotch or is it something more along the lines of maybe a wine or a sake kind of thing?
More similar to a Scotch because it's, and it's 2000 years old. It's a deep part of the culture. They say you can't set the table without Baijiu. It's grain-based, but it's a solid-state fermentation. It's amazing. And then it's aged and blended, so similar to a scotch, but it's white-colored instead of brown-colored because you age it in big clay pots, so it doesn't pick up any color.
Wow. Okay. Well, and you've obviously traveled in the name of some of these different spirits and products, and over the last handful of years, people are starting to do the same. 2002, that was back in the infancy of, you know, I think we were all eating at the Olive Garden back then. Now that I think about it, I'm just kidding. But as you travel, and as so many other people are thinking to themselves, you know, I want to travel, and not for the reasons that are still, you know, wonderful, you sit on a beach and have a cocktail, or go to an amusement park, or even see, you know, historical, you know, artifacts and ruins and things. You're finding people now that are wanting to travel for food reasons, right? They want to go and experience, you want to forage for truffles somewhere, or they want to, you know, make wine in the Tuscan foothills or something like that. And so when people see the things that you've done for work, right, but then they want to do it kind of for pleasure, what are some of the really, really cool places you've been that make for a great vacation?
One fabulous place to do enotourism or gastrotourism is the south of France. And I actually brought us some wine from there, from one of the best Cru Classé wineries in Provence, which is called Château Saint-Maur. Like, give me more.
Okay. And you said that really well, too.
Thank you. My parents were generous enough to support a year abroad when I was growing up, so I learned to speak a little French along the way. But Château Saint-Maur is a beautiful winery in Provence. Traveling around Provence is beautiful. Jose and I were actually stuck in the south of France during Hurricane Sandy a few years ago.
Is that the correct term for it, stuck? Or would you say we were fortunately detained?
We were fortunately detained in the south of France and took a marvelous road trip through the big cities, the little cities, the vineyards, the ancient sites. And visiting wineries there is also a great, great thing to do. At our property at Château Saint-Maur, there's a free art exhibit open to the public in the summer. We have an artist in residence, and of course you can taste a lot of great wine.
And over the years, I remember when you were working with and helping Laurent Perrier like share some of their things. And I know as a journalist working in the food business and in and around it, you know, as I have, you know, I have some access to be able to see and do these things. But when you have, and these are wonderful, but they're businesses, right? This isn't a tourist attraction necessarily. Are the places that you go, are they starting to kind of get more used to people wanting to show up from all around the world and experience it? And are they kind of ready for that? I mean, or do you have to know somebody in order to get in?
I'd say it's increasingly easy. Wine tourism is a very important part of the economy in a lot of the countries that I happen to work with. For example, another region we work with is in Portugal. It's called Tejo. It's just an hour inland from Lisbon. And it was really established in the Middle Ages when people were given land grants to live there. But you had to plant an olive grove and you had to plant a vineyard. So it has a very old winemaking tradition.
Wow. Well, see, there's so much. I mean, that's part of it, too. And, of course, you've got to retain some of that, you know, some of the history of the regions, because there's always these great backstories, sometimes going back, you know, centuries or even, you know, 1,000 years or something like that, as opposed to we've got Budweiser here. You know, we've got there's some history there, I guess. But as you move forward and you do that and you go to the different places there, are they appreciating the interest from Americans in the whole food? I mean, it's relatively new here as far as people traveling for culinary reasons, but is it something that they're excited about? I know worldwide, but...
Absolutely. Tourists are always very, very welcome. And in fact, the wine world and the food world are just friendly worlds. Of course, the hospitality world is hospitable. So everywhere that I've gone, I've always felt very, very welcome. And people want to share their local food culture, which almost always includes wine or spirits as well.
So for people, as they kind of share their experiences for the 4th of July weekend, whether it's family and friends, and they want to, you know, they're going to have a certain amount of whatever in whatever kind of incarnation their cookout or backyard kind of festival takes. But if they wanted to enjoy some wines, you have some selections, a handful of things that people can get. I guess they can get them at Binny's, right? Or is it?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I lined up a little series.
Christine's like, I have one bottle that I spirited out of this remote country, and that's what I've got. So you've got to get with me. So these are things that people can actually enjoy.
Absolutely. I lined up a little series that I call Red, White, and Rosé, perfect for 4th of July. So for the red, I selected actually a sangria, which comes in a box. It's called Beso del Sol, which means kiss of the sun.
You mean a box is like the old like white Zinfandel was in the refrigerator many, many years ago? See, what's interesting about, and this is, I wanted to get this point. Okay, go on with these. And then on the packaging, I did want to ask some other questions too, but go with the others.
Sure. Well, the beauty of the box actually is it keeps things very, very fresh for a very long time. After your Peso del Sol is open, you can keep it at least 8 weeks. And it's very eco-friendly. It's actually much more eco-friendly than glass to have wine in boxes. The box wine industry is booming, and the quality inside of the box is very, very good right now. In fact, Peso del Sol Sangria has beat out in blind tastings at Disney sangrias that the sommeliers have made.
So, whoa.
Yeah, excellent quality. 100% Tempranillo grapes from Spain, which makes it true sangria. Great for cookouts. If you're having burgers, if you're having pizza, anything around the pool you can have with this because it's not glass.
Right.
And just at home in a glass.
Oh, that's okay. That's a great one. And that's actually something that people can do. I may actually pick one of those up tomorrow. Okay. And the next one?
And I just want to say, pick it up at Jewel Osco. That's an easy place to find it in the Chicago area.
Nice.
Yep. So for white, I was actually thinking about that region in Portugal that we spoke about, Tejo, because their white wines are really zippy, almost lemony. And so anywhere that you always see the name Tejo on the back of a bottle, which is spelled T-E-J-O, Binny's does have a bunch.
Okay.
And anything you would put a little squeeze of lemon on is great with a white wine from Tejo. So if you're having a Frisch or if you're having a Korn or anything that you want to spark up with a little acidity, it's a great idea.
And what I'm assuming the price point for the boxed one that you first mentioned is relatively approachable. For Tejo, is this reasonable as well?
Great question. Yeah. So the Peso del Sol, a box, a 3-liter box, which is like 4 bottles of wine, costs $20.
Nice.
So that's about $5 a bottle. Incredible value.
Okay.
Then the wines from Tejo are generally between $11 and $13
okay,
a bottle.
Still really great.
Yeah, still affordable for a crowd and really good price-quality ratio because the region is less known. So very well-known regions, the wines are more expensive. Lesser-known regions, you get more value because there's just not as much demand for them yet.
Right. And plus, maybe they're trying to price them in a way that can allow people to enjoy them and become fans, right?
Yeah.
And then the last one that we've got.
Well, then we're going rosé, and I took something more at the premium end of the scale. If this is a cru classé rosé called Château Saint-Maur, so there are more than 700 wineries in Provence, but only 18 of them are cru classé. So that's like saying Grand Cru for a Burgundy or a Bordeaux. So this one is called L'Excellence from Château Saint-Maur. It's easy to buy off of wine.com, and it's about $40 or $45 a bottle, which can seem like a lot of money for a bottle of wine, but when it's the very best the region has to offer,
right,
it's actually extremely good value.
That's awesome. So these are great things. So a bunch of different price points, and you've got stuff in a box, and you've got a really considerate price-wise wine, and then you've got something just a little bit more. But then again, like you said, there is value in having the best and getting to experience the best from that particular region. And in the last minute or so, here's the thing is, your tradition is so important in the world of wine, right? You've got all these vineyards and all the history and all those kind of things. And of course, we've got the glass and the corks, which were usually seen as a compromise to quality, right? If you're in a box in the refrigerator, it wasn't seen as like, wow, how great. It's like, geez, that must have been really, you know, cheap, right?
Right.
But now you're seeing, you know, synthetic corks or caps even, mm-hmm. and now you're seeing boxes. As you talk to some of those people who've been doing it for so long, how are they feeling about these kind of new, I don't know, advancements or just changes in what they're doing?
People who work in the wine industry have known for a long time that bag and box actually preserves quality extremely well because there's a bladder inside. And as you take the wine out, the bladder compresses, so you're not getting a lot of wine mixed in with your air. They also know that alternatives to cork can be very, very helpful, particularly for fresh wines you're drinking right away, like the white wines from Tejo, because real cork can be tainted. That's where corked wine comes from. Whereas if it's synthetic, it can't breathe. That's the downside. So you don't want it for long term. But for short term, a wine that you're drinking young, it's a great alternative.
You're never going to get those surprise bad bottles, or at least the chances are less. Okay. Well, you are going to be enjoying Chicago as Chicago enjoys, and your family, of course, enjoys you. So before we let you go, you know, give whatever information you want on how people can either follow you on social media or get a hold of you over at Deussen Global and keep up with all your adventures.
Thank you for that. Our Twitter is @Deussen Global. Our email is info@deussenglobal.com. Deussen is spelled D-E-U-S-S-E-N.
Christine Deussen, she knows everything that you would want to know about the wine world, the hospitality world, and so honored to have you in the studio tonight.
Thank you, Dane.
All right, so right now we're going to take a quick break. It is Dane in for Dave Hoekstra on the Nocturnal Journal. We'll be back right after this.
I think California cuisine sort of started taking hold in the 70s, right? So if you have a farmer's market in your neighborhood, you can think California cuisine. If you like the idea of grilling steaks and putting fresh tomatoes and basil and olive oil on top of it, you can think California cuisine. If you're really passionate about organics and you really want to know where things came from, you can credit California cuisine.
WGN here with, you know, you've got to say, in the world of food and food television, one of the cornerstones, doing so much with Food Network, Tyler Forrest. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be a part of it.
There has been kind of a common theme of mentorship. Andrew Zimmern just did a panel over at the Trade Talks about mentorship. And one of the themes has been kind of those, just do the work. Do the work. Try to be good at it. Make it a passion. Make it something that you love to do. And in the end, ideally success will come and you realize that it isn't for you. For you, and we've talked before, we've done interviews where, you know, the whole success on television thing has been kind of just a side effect of the hard work and being in the right place at the right time, of course.
Right. And like, to me, I think you should always jump into food or jump into the idea of being successful in the food business with the idea that television doesn't exist, right? And you have to be really, really good at what you want to do first and foremost, right? You have to be a really great caterer or a really great chef or a really great food stylist or a really great cookbook author or a combination of all the above. And then, like, these other things start to happen, but if you don't have the fundamentals or the foundation of you being a talented artist or having the credibility of saying, I have done this, the other stuff will probably never show up, right? So a lot of people feel, and this is sort of a curse of social media to a younger audience. They see celebrity as something that's so, like, right there in front of them at all times. And they feel like it's easy to be famous, but they don't really know what they want to be famous for as much as they just want to be famous, right? So the difference between being famous and being great is just how much hard work you can put into something. And fame is fleeting, right? But if you're a talented artist, you'll work forever. And that's my advice to people. Like, you have to dive deep into who you are as a person, and you have to live that and walk that every single day. And all these other things just sort of fall in your lap.
It was interesting seeing you get to share some of your experiences and impart some advice to a young fan. And that's kind of what you're doing here in different capacities at the Aspen Food and Wine Classic. So as you go around the country, you do the seminars, you do the demos, you're telling stories, you're sharing messages as you're entertaining. How rewarding is that to be able to do that and the feedback that you get?
Specifically here in Aspen, it's amazing. We do a lot of food and wine festivals, New York City, South Beach, Pebble Beach, Los Angeles, but there's something really magical about the attention that everybody gives everybody here in Aspen because it's so small and it sells out pretty fast. So if you want to come next year, you should start thinking about it now. But everyone's so accessible, right? I mean, you get a chance to kind of walk up to somebody who maybe you see on television or you've read the cookbooks, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, hey, you, let's just have a glass of wine. And these magical moments happen all the time. So it's a good spot to kind of come and sort of like see what other people are doing, literally at the highest level, right? And then if you get a chance to kind of like rub elbows with and meet somebody and get a handshake and get a business card, these things are great, right? Like, being in the right place at the right time is so important. Now, and it's not always what you know. Now, it's what you know that matters once you get past that. But it's who you know that kind of gets you through the door.
That knows what you know and appreciates it.
You know what I'm talking about? That gets you to the next level, which I think is really kind of interesting. So there's a lot of opportunities here to meet people in the wine world and the food business. On a large level, like you're here with KitchenAid, I mean, like, you know, big, huge brands that are here. So you'll bump into so many cool people that make the food world work here in Aspen. And so it's like this kind of cool fan thing, but it's also this big, like, professional event at the same time. And it's the best of both worlds.
What you did as far as kind of bringing, like, nationwide consciousness to the food truck situation, I think was big.
And here you're sharing California cuisine. Of course, the San Francisco home place, great restaurants and all that. So when you have people from all around the country, maybe all around the world, mm-hmm. like how do you best describe California cuisine?
I think California cuisine is a really strong, organic movement that sort of started taking hold in the 70s, right? So if you have a farmer's market in your neighborhood, you can think California cuisine. If you like the idea of like grilling steaks and putting fresh tomatoes and basil and olive oil on top of it, you can think California cuisine. If you're really passionate about organics and you really want to know where things came from, you can credit California cuisine. So there's so many wonderful things that come from that. It's a very loose cookery, right? I mean, it's really about like rustic wood grills and like fresh vegetables and kind of coming together at the same time. It's very market driven, but that because I'm in California, I work in California. I'm in the tech business. I have restaurants. I make wine. We film there. I'm actually going to be the new face of California. I just signed a big deal with.
Are you serious?
I signed a new deal with Visit California, so I'm going to be the new face of California, which I'm very excited about.
Very cool.
The two amazingly iconic programs. I think I interviewed you maybe 10 years ago when you did the Got Milk campaign, which was, when you think about it, from
the
food.
Same photographer shot both.
Wow. So now you are the face of California. That is saying something. That's a lot of pressure to stay good looking.
We do. thank you. I'm 45 this year. I'm trying to hold down. But this is a giving example. This is what the ad campaign is going to look like, right? So we went riding motorcycles around the Bay Area, which is so much fun. That's what a custom Triumph motorcycle I have. Yeah. It's cool. I had a good time. So that's coming out in the fall. So to me, like I love where I live, and I feel like I have found sort of not only my creative community, but my spiritual home in a lot of ways, because like it's just my mind is opened up a lot in California. So I think if I can just spread that gospel, I think I'll be doing good for the rest of my life.
So I got to experience your cuisine at El Paseo, and it was like the first time I really felt like I experienced California cuisine. Mm. I mean, it was stunning. First of all, visually beautiful, and it kind of changed the way I cook. I got your cookbook, and it was fantastic. What I did feel while I was there was mentorship. I totally felt that your team mm-hmm. really got a lot from you. You were working with them and serving our table, and the respect, you could see the respect from all of the folks. So tell me about your mentorship in your restaurants and, you know, kind of what your attitudes are towards that.
I really believe, or I'd like to think what happens is what I want it to happen. But when our employees leave our restaurant, especially at the management level, I want it to be the most important thing that ever happened to them professionally, hands down, right? So all of my guys, especially my chefs, they haven't left to go work for someone else. They've left to go open their own restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. Because I show them how to run a business, right? We have these like P&L meetings, short meetings every 2 weeks, but a big one every month. And all the departments kind of come together, and everybody's responsible for it. And we're very transparent about where all the money comes from, where all the money goes, right? And because I want them to be able to get in the rhythm of knowing how to successfully run a restaurant. Because, like, at the end of the day, they're going to walk out of this place after our 10 years up, and my name is going to be in the resume, and I want it to mean something, right? Mm-hmm. I really want it to mean something. I want them to be worth more because they spent some time with me, and I want them to be more successful because they understand the fundamentals of how to work a business. Anybody can make a great scallop, but if you don't understand how to run a business on a day-to-day basis, you're going to bankrupt the company, a restaurant, in 5 months flat, right? So it's critical. And out of everything that I do, right, my happiest moments professionally are standing there on the line, wiping rims, putting garnishes on plates, and talking to my guys about how that could be 5% better on the next pickup, right? And I just love that because you look at them like, yeah, we chef. And like, do me a favor, like, leave the fish in the pan for 2 more seconds. It'll be crispier, right? And like, we chef, right? And I just love that, right? These moments, because they'll never forget that. They'll never forget it, right? And I feel like the world has been really good to me in a lot of ways. Like, and I feel like I've worked hard for what I have, but I feel like when we got in this good place, I feel like the energy that you put out is energy you get back in a lot of ways. So that I just want to keep sending that out as much as possible, because I think like all of my guys, we'll just continue to propagate everything, you know, and they'll learn something. I just got a phone call, heartbreaking story. I just got a phone call last week from a former executive chef at Wayfair Tavern, and the restaurant that he opened less than a year ago closed, mm-hmm. right? And he says, "Chef, we're closing in 2 weeks," right? And he was crying on the phone, right? And it was so heartbreaking, the fact that he picked up the phone to me and called me and let me know what was going on. Like, that to me meant something. Because I always want to stay in touch with my guys, right? And then over the phone, we started diving into like a creative way to reuse that space so he wouldn't lose his investors' money. And then we turned it into, at least on paper anyway, an event space, because I don't think he didn't really understand the power of the event business in San Francisco, right? So it's like, so we, you know, we can't operate this on a daily basis, but I'm like, brother, for like, you could actually do 10 or 15 big dinners a month for private events and you could have this whole thing. So I got a chance to like turn that ship around, but he came to me first and I just felt like it was so honored that, you know, our relationship 2 years ago meant so much to him that he would still do that now. So I love what I do. I just love what I do. I love the fact that we can, you know, sell out any room and any cooking demo and any culinary events in the country and really have a great time with people and give them something to take home. I love it.
On a personal level, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. It is a true blessing to love what it is that you do, but to pay it forward like you do, even by just being here and sharing what it is that you do with the people who are getting out to the events, and then also on the mentorship side, and then helping to give those careers, those livelihoods, that passion to that next generation of chefs that are coming on. It's absolutely awesome. It's the kind of thing that it's great that you're sharing. A lot of these things happen. People don't even know about it. So it's great to be able to share that, not only what you do, but what you're doing with everybody else.
Thank you.
So for those people who want to keep up with you, see you out in California. Yep. See you in Chicago when you come to, you know, maybe see a Cubs game or something like
Chicago,
that.
Love Chicago. You know, it's one of my favorite cities in America. And congratulations on such a dynamic restaurant scene. You know, it's so exciting to watch. You know, Grant Achatz with Alinea is the number 5 restaurant in the world right now. I mean,
who's counting?
Yeah, but it's
look at the James Beard Awards.
James Beard Award this year. Big. You know, it's really, really big. I mean, Chicago holds its own. There's no doubt about it.
You know what? For a guy that embodies an entire state now, it's an impressive stuff. Of course, we love to have you in Chicago, all around the country. They love you here at the Aspen Food and Wine Classic. People want to catch up with you. They want to see you out at Wayfair, see you out at your places out in California. If people want to see you online, social media, where can they go?
At Tyler Florence on Instagram and on Twitter.
Tyler Florence, thanks so much for what you do, and thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Great to see you guys again.
WGN, Dane Neal, Allstate Showcase Studio, in on the Nocturnal Journal with Dave Hoekstra. Dave is out at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn enjoying the American Music Festival that's going on there today and tomorrow. So many cool things are happening all around the city. Of course, you know, Summerfest is up and going. It is the world's largest outdoor music festival. Taste of Chicago is right around the corner. It's more than a taste. Of course, there's so many great bands that are coming up with that as well. And then Naperville Rib Fest, it's about ribs, but I think the real draw, well, at least one of the draws, is the music acts. And they usually have a pretty elevated kind of music list there for that. So go ahead and text in 312-981-7200 with your favorite music festival or maybe your favorite venue. If you've been out to Fitzgerald's, you know that you love that. And there's some great suburban ones as well. And I want to get to some of the texts. Let's see, what are some of the people? Well, one of the things, of course, 312, and you can text in about whatever, and we'll try to get to that. Cubs are making some sweet music themselves, some bad music, you know, against the Mets recently. But I think the Cubs should trade Schwarber and 2 prospects to the Sox for Chris Sale. That came in from the 312. We'll take that under advisement. So on the line with us, we've got Dave Hoekstra, the Nocturnal Journal man himself, and he is out at Fitzgerald's. Dave, welcome back to your show.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. We're hanging out in this camper van, 9x20. It's cozy, but it's nice. It's really nice.
No, okay, so you've already done this, and I know for fans of the show, you've already mentioned that you've had the people who designed it, that built it for you, the camper van. So it does have some of the accoutrements of a residence. You mentioned camper. You think you could live in it, sleep in it, take it on vacation?
Yeah, that's what I've done. I'm looking around it now. It's got a bed in the back. I put a little desk in it because I was under the idea, and maybe this will happen on my next journey, that I drive a little bit, interview people, and then ride at night. Well, I was pretty tired by the time all that was done. So, I've got Wi-Fi on here, so I did set up my computer. I didn't do a lot of writing, but it's got a desk, and it's got an interview chair where we just did an interview, so the guests can sit in the chair. So it's like a little traveling office, you know, 2 chairs up front, got a little television set, DVD player. Like, we drove the van. It's on our website. We drove the van on Pismo Beach because that's where they filmed The Birds. So I brought the DVD of The Birds, but never watched that. And it was just, there was a lot of driving in this last 3 weeks. So it was a pretty exhausting trip. I did get out a few times to see minor league baseball. That was a good thing. I saw the Inland Empire 66ers, and I saw the Tulsa Drillers. It was good to get out of the van and go to some baseball games.
You have to have the facilities, and you've customized the van to be able to provide you not only the shelter that you need, but the work environment. Now, you're having a lot of really great people that people are interested in hearing from, and of course, you're always a super curious guy as well. So through these travels, as you have traveled, and you've been to some really awesome places, you know, all up through that highway, up through Northern California. Do you ever just find somebody that may not be, you know, on your list to interview, or maybe not even a celebrity, and you said, "Hey, let's get in the van. I'd like to talk to you. Let's do an interview right here."
Yeah, we did that. And my other books are about, you know, Sense of Place and supper clubs and soul food restaurants of the civil rights movement and places that are fixed and places that people go back to over and over and over again and have, you know, people latch into that. But here I wanted to see what would happen when place is fluid, when place is always moving around, when no one's ever really in one place, you know. And I found some people, in Idaho, I found a traveling nurse in her early 40s, and her family just like dropped out. And they just, what she does is she gets gigs every 3 months at different hospitals, and they're homeschooling their kids. They sold their house, and they're living out of an RV and stuff. It's bigger than what I've got and stuff, but they've got like three kids, and it really seems to be trending up. People think, and you know, I'm just starting this journey. I'm gonna go on a few more, but people think it's just like a bunch of retirees. But I'm seeing younger people. I saw, in researching the book over the winter, I saw like some people in their mid-20s in Key West, and they were just telecommuting out of there. And they had like the same thing I've got. They got like a Ford Transit van, and they were just doing all their work with their dogs out of the van. So it's part of a whole, I heard this a lot on this trip too, it's part of a whole small living, tiny home movement, people dumping stuff, people just, you know, liking being able to move around and seeing a lot of stuff.
The technology has really, and we've talked about that, I've been talking with a few different people about just how either this business radio has changed, or even being in bands and the ability to record. When we were kids, you know, we had a terrible 4-track recorder that had a cassette tape in it. And now you have these amazing tools, and the technology really, and you're right, Dave, it has allowed people to be able to do so many different jobs, almost any work from almost anywhere. And so when you think about it, as opposed to, you know, the generations of people working out of a cubicle, driving in for a commute, when you can kind of extract that from the equation, it's really, really cool.
And you know what I found? And I mean, I've camped before. I mean, not in long-term situations like this, but I've rented RVs for the Sun-Times. I've done tent camping on Natchez Trace and stuff. But after even just spending 3 weeks pretty much solid in campgrounds, it's just the sense of community is pretty strong. People are friendly. People are always willing to help you out. You know, I did have technical glitches, and they're really tight. And this woman I talk about, who's a traveling nurse, they've made friends. They keep in touch, and they meet at different campgrounds, and there's a little thing, you know, going on there, you know. It's
That's what I did want to ask you that, because just like anything, whether you're into craft beer or whether you're into fishing or certain sports, once you realize that you have that kind of common touchstone with someone else, and you find out that this whole community of people that have all of that in common, is there kind of this whole kind of, I don't want to say a subculture, but this whole kind of group of people, and what kind of things do you share? Is it like, oh, if you're driving there, you've got to stop at this place? And is it for reasons that maybe people who don't do this wouldn't understand?
Yeah, there was a lot of that. Check this out, check that out. I don't know if this is part of my personal journey. I lost both my folks, but there were a lot of people going to see parents, or going to take care of their parents and stuff. People, you know, in the 50s and stuff, they were traveling. I think the ability to be flexible and just move around and stuff like this makes, in a way, brings families together a little bit more. And obviously none of these people are just jumping on planes and running out to see somebody, but a good handful of people I saw. I came back with 18 to 20 interviews and for the book, and I'd say, you know, 20-30% of them were on the road for family type obligations and stuff.
Sat in with Wendy on just the other day, and we talked about kind of that road trip. You know, people do it in the summertime, pack everybody up, kind of head out. It was the kind of the cost-effective vacation that everybody used to do. You're seeing, I think, probably less and less of that, unless people are getting back into it. But when you're traveling and you're doing it for work, obviously, and you're at least part of it, right? You're experiencing it all too. Are you lured in by, and are there still those kind of attractions out there that we always heard about and that we experienced as kids, like the world's largest ball of twine or dinosaur land, or, you know, kind of these like D-list, attractions, but they're big when you're on the road with nothing to do.
I love the unexpected. I mean, I went by Wild Drug and all the stuff in the Dakotas and stuff. But one thing I did for the station that's not even part of the book is this in Great Falls, Montana, called the O'Hare Motor Inn. I got out of the van and I stayed there one night. A segment will play on the air in probably a few weeks and stuff. But it's a bar. They have a bar in the middle of Great Falls, Montana, where they have live mermaids. They swim behind the bar. You know, I just love crazy stuff like that. I like the dichotomy of there you are in the middle of Montana, and mermaids are swimming behind the bar, and they've got an 85-year-old piano player playing lounge songs and stuff. Did a great version of Move It On Over, not the Hank Williams style, but kind of the George Thorogood style.
Wow.
And it was just like, so yeah, I just like, and that's the thing, that's the beauty of travel. I mean, just the unpredictable and just going off your agenda. I mean, I had stuff typed up for the trip. I had an outline I was supposed to follow, but sometimes the surprises are the best part of traveling, you know, good and bad.
Generations of people, and it's been there for as long as you can remember, but I'm so excited. I mentioned it the other day when we were talking about the road trips, and Wendy had never even heard of it, but Wild Drug, I remember going to Wild Drug. I think I had a bison burger, you know, when I was a kid or something like that. So kind of revisit for all those people that are hearing this. Wild Drug is one of those iconic kind of family road trip, you know, traveling places that everybody stops. It's still there, huh?
Wild Drug is still there. Yeah, they were closed by the time I was going through there, but I did stop at the Corn Palace, which is down the road, and I think it's Mitchell.
Right.
And they're great. You know, they redo the corn exterior every year, and this year they've got Willie Nelson and Elvis, I think, so it's a musical theme and stuff. I love that place. I've been to the Corn Palace before, you know, all the exteriors in corn, and the birds do leave the corn alone. Once I wrote about it for the paper, I can't remember, but the birds do leave that corn alone. They don't peck at it or anything. But the thing I want to do with the Corn Palace, I'd like to go back. I don't know if I want to make the drive in the winter, is they do have like basketball tournaments in there. I just love to see a basketball game in the Corn Palace. It's like a really, really small arena and stuff. But Corn Palace and Wild Drug you can do in one swoop. It's a pretty, pretty convenient run.
Wow. Two amazing places that are the kind of places that you do see when you finally get in there and you take that trip. It may not be quick, but it is the kind of thing that I think is greater than the sum of its parts, right? The road trip, you know, where you experience things. You don't know what you're going to do, but you know you're going to see some great stuff.
Yeah, and I was blessed. I had great weather and just great sunsets. And this trip started off on a really good foot. It was really, really nice.
So the weather is great right now. And, of course, it's a beautiful time for great music. And we're going to take a break. When we come back from the news, though, you're going to get us on the phone with Bill Fitzgerald. He's going to chat about the fest that's coming up because it's going on tonight, going on as we speak, and, of course, tomorrow, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Bill will give you an update and, you know, ask him a few questions about the history. This is the 35th anniversary for the festival.
Oh, it's great. On location in the van, the camper van, it is Dave Hoekstra himself, Nocturnal Joe. Dave, we're going to check back in with you in a second after the news.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, man. It's Dane Neal in the Allstate Showcase studio in for Dave on Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. WGN, Dane Neal, Allstate Showcase Studio in the Nocturnal Journal. Dave Hoekstra, he is on location in the camper van, the truckster, if you will, out there at Fitzgerald's for the American Music Fest, and we've got him back on the line. Dave, are you here?
Yeah, we found Bill Fitzgerald. Where were you at, Bill? Were you at the soundboard? Okay, yeah, so Bill's here. He's ready to talk to you.
All right. This is exciting.
Okay, here's Dane Neal. Hey, Dane, how you doing?
Hey, Bill, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, you're doing great on a regular basis because you have the responsibility or the luxury or the pleasure or the opportunity to provide so many people for so many years with things that they'll remember, talk about, and enjoy for years to come. That's a pretty cool gig.
Man, I cannot tell you, this year more than ever, so many people come up and they're telling me stories about memories, you know, experiences, you know, the best night they ever had musically, and sometimes many, many years ago. And they're very thankful, and they're having fun, and they're here. And what a great vibe we have here tonight. It's so much fun.
On the music side, I'm sure there's a lot of people in so many different bands and experiences, and people share that. Hey, I saw, you know, so-and-so there however many years ago. Do you ever get the thing where people come up and say, I met my wife, you know, we've got, you know, this many kids
now? We have to have like a reunion here. People who first dates, you know, met my wife there, all that. There's many, many people like that that have had stories like that. So that'd be a lot of fun to do that.
Well, there's memories being made as we speak, as you're in the van, people are in the venue enjoying it, not only enjoying the music, but of course, maybe meeting that certain special someone and certainly seeing some special acts. So let's talk about it. The American Music Fest at Fitzgerald's, you've been doing it for a number of years. It's going on now. What are people hearing?
Well, this year, I mean, this is our 35th celebration. I mean, just tonight alone, I mean, it's, I kept calling tonight the kitchen sink because we had everything. I mean, we got my one of my favorites, Kevin Gordon. I just walked out of a set with the Zimmermen, who are our local guys that cover Dylan. And they were lucky enough to have Willie Nile sit in, Robbie Faulks with their feature, John Fulbright, who's playing now in the club, sat in. And they had all three of them up there at the same time, and it was spectacular. I mean, I've never heard an ovation quite like that. It was really cool. And they were all kind of like, well, maybe we'll do it, maybe we won't. And they're all game to do it, and it worked out fantastic. So it's a lot of fun.
35 years, and now the momentum is there, and obviously there's going to be a 36 through 40 through 50 as long as you can do it. Were there any early years where you said, I don't know if this is catching on, maybe we won't do it anymore? Or were there any kind of times where you kind of questioned what you were doing?
You know, I kind of feel that way. Sometimes you go into something like this and you're a little fatigued by it, and you wonder how it's going to work out, and should we do 2 days, 3 days? This year we were supposed to do 3 days, and we decided to do four because there's so many acts that want to play it. But I got to tell you, once the thing starts, you know, you look at it, it's on paper, you're promoting it, you're thinking about it, you're worried about the days of the week, the weather. But once it gets going and the musicians start playing and the fans show up, it's really a great – it's a marathon for us, but it's a great life experience, and it really – put the nice cap on our year here, it's wonderful.
Well, people are still trying to get out there. They're going to be enjoying it for the rest of the night. We had a texter from the 708 stuck in traffic on the Bishop Ford trying to get there, probably 20 or 30 minutes away. So people are still kind of getting there. Even though it's a little later in the evening, people are still trying to get out there to enjoy what you have going on left tonight. And then, of course, you've got all day tomorrow.
Yeah, we have a lot left tonight. We've got Willie Niles full set in the tent. Fulbright's on now. We've got Robbie Faulks is going to close the club. And I think Kevin Gordon's going to play a second set in the sidebar, the little tiny sidebar. He already played a great show in the club, and I got to mix it, which was a thrill. But he's playing a late set, I think about 10:30. And I think Charlie Pierce, who lived in Chicago for a while, he's got a group called Choctaw Wildfire. They're going to play a late set. They put all their gear in the basement. They're going to bring it up at midnight and play some more. So it's one of those kind of nights.
It's nice to have your own place, right? It's nice.
Yeah, 3 o'clock license in Berwyn. They don't mess around here.
That'll stay open after that.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so people are going to be loving it tonight till whenever, till at least 3 o'clock, and then tomorrow for sure, the whole time.
Tomorrow is the finale, and it's going to be a great day. I mean, it's, you know, when you have a gig where you can look at, you know, the Cactus Blossoms, James McMurtry, Dos Lobos, which is Cesar Rosas and David Hidalgo, we have a Chicago band they're going to play together with. They're going to play their own stuff, and they're going to do a tribute to the Chicago blues history, I guess. And when you have a finish like that, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, so this year's is one of the best in memory, but 35 years looking back, are there a couple like key moments that you look back at and say like, wow, that was really cool?
Oh man, there's so many. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, to me, it's the, I enjoy this tonight, just seeing other musicians here enjoying each other in the dressing room or standing out in front of somebody else's stage and enjoying what they're doing. I love that. They get this, you know, it's just a nice thing to see the music community and the fans and musicians all together hanging out, having a blast, and you can't beat it.
Well, letting the listeners know we're talking with Bill Fitzgerald from Fitzgerald's out there in Berwyn, and that's got to be almost maybe the highest compliment that you can have for what it is that you do. And not only do you, you know, are you there for the place, but behind the scenes, you know, doing some of the mixing, is that as much as the fans enjoy it and the memories that they have and they make, but that for the bands themselves, like they want to be a part of it. They love playing at your place. That's high praise.
Yeah, John Fulbright said to me, this is kind of like the anti-festival. You know, it's relaxed. No one's, like, worried about the schedule and freaking out about stuff. It's a family affair, and it's a lot more easygoing, and I think they enjoy that part of it. So
exciting stuff. It's going to be going on tonight and tomorrow. People are going to enjoy it. But, of course, Fitzgerald's, you're there all the time. For people who want to get a hold of the schedule, see what other bands, what other shows, events are coming up, what's the website for you?
It's FitzgeraldsNightclub.com.
FitzgeraldsNightclub.com. Still going on right now, 35 years for the American Music Festival. Bill Fitzgerald, the man behind so much of everything that's going on. Bill, thanks so much for being on the show tonight, and get back in there and enjoy some of what's going to be an amazing weekend.
I will do. I'll walk. I won't run.
All right. Safety thanks. First. Thanks, Bill.
All right.
All right, we are going to take a break here on 720 WGN. And when we come back, we are going to have Sarah Moulton. Chef Sarah Moulton will be joining us talking about her brand new book. It's Dane in for Dave on the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, Dane Neal in the Allstate Showcase studio, honored to have in Chicago as she travels the country on a tour for her latest book. And a groundbreaking, pioneering television personality, award-winning author, chef, and a person who has been kind of our guide to the food world on television and, of course, in print for so many years, the one and only Chef Sarah Moulton. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Dane.
So what brings you here? I mean, you're traveling, and you could be in other places. There's Topeka, Kansas, probably down the road, maybe across.
Well, no, Chicago would be, I think, a little before Topeka, Kansas.
Oh, they go in order of importance? Awesome.
Well, yeah. Well, although, no, don't get me wrong. I'm not a snob that way. And actually, I'm on book tour with this wonderful little cookware company called Chantal. And where they take me are all these tiny little, well, not tiny, but not the big cities. So to find myself in Chicago is unusual.
Well, it's great to have you here. And when, of course, we sat in the lobby, you're like, oh, this is great. Excited to be able to do it. And we're just honored and excited to have you. And you got to think about it. Sure, big cities, a lot of people. But when you do what you've done, whether it's Good Morning America or with Julia Child, of course, all the stuff on the Food Network, you've got to figure that most everybody would be excited to see you. Everybody knows who you are.
Well, you know, I'm not the hottest thing since sliced bread, you know, when I, like when I was for the 10 years on the Food Network. So it doesn't always translate. But, you know, new people are beginning to watch my public television show and Create, which is this second network that takes all the PBS shows and then puts them up after they've aired the first time, is really helping us all to get the shows out more than they do.
It is great to have some of the advantages we have, either with YouTube or some of those things. You say sliced bread. I just watched earlier today a segment that you did with someone that I talked to yesterday, Rachel Ray, and you were talking about refreshing bread that was stale, putting it into the oven, getting it wet, soaking it. It's those kind of things, those kind of life hacks and ways to make some kitchen magic. Is that the stuff that's in Home Cooking 101?
Yeah, among other things. I mean, there's really nerdy stuff like that. But then there's also, you know, the first chapter is all about the things that I think are most important, like get to know your stove, because gas does not perform like electric, does not perform like, induction. How to balance flavors if something's too sweet, salty, sour, hot. How to build umami. How to use salt, you know, which is hands down the most important thing. So I go through all that kind of stuff, you know, that basic stuff. And then there's a lot of little fun things along the way.
A lot of cool stuff in the world of food, and I'm sure some valuable information all across the board. And in studio, we also have Beth Peterson, world recipe champion, Master Chef alum, and of course, one of the founders of the Yummy Nation. And so, Beth, you actually got a chance.
Yeah.
You had the pleasure, the honor of running into Sarah before as well.
Spent a little bit of time together. We went to Duck University for Maple Leaf Farms.
It's so nice to say Duck University. You should say Duck U.
Duck U.
It gets everybody's
I was
attention.
Trying to be polite.
Guys,
but
it's a family show. So.
That was our handle on Twitter. It was Duck You.
Yeah, it was.
It was kind of fun.
It was really fun. We even got to eat. We were talking about a duck food, what they eat, and well, this is Amish country. This is a wonderful company called Maple Leaf Farms.
Yeah,
duck and. You know, I think we really both enjoyed.
It was great.
Yeah, felt good about the ducks.
There were food writers from all around the country that came out to learn about the farm, and I was scared. I was telling Sarah, I was really kind of a little bit afraid to see like what behind the scenes of a duck farm looked like, and it was pretty good.
Yeah.
It wasn't so bad.
No, it wasn't bad.
And of course, we got fabulous duck meals at the end of the night, and Sarah went through and she did demos for us all day and taught us all about how to cook duck, and yeah, so it was an awesome experience.
Duck has become, you know, one of those really hot things, you know, as far as the food scene goes. And Sarah, I wanted to ask you just the time that you've been, certainly there are some classics, there are some things, some staples, some mainstays, but what are your thoughts as the next thing becomes the hot this or the hot that, or, you know, or like small plates, you know, whatever kind of trend it is.
Ooh, I love this.
Comes in and out of fashion.
Well, I'm not always good at this stuff because I've had my head in the sand for 2 years doing this cookbook, but I think it always has to do with unfortunately, what countries we're doing war with or we're concerned about. So Korean food is very big. It has been. It's been growing. Middle Eastern food is huge. You know, I think we're going to continue to see more of that. And Mediterranean in general, you know, the whole Ottolenghi thing.
Yeah. Right?
Yes. And all the spices. And you know what's so much fun? When I started cooking, which was, of course, when I was just 12, graduated from cooking school in 1977, you could not find what you can find now. You know, when I first worked at Gourmet Magazine in the mid-'80s, and we had a recipe that called for sesame oil, and I mean the dark stuff, we would say, available at specialty food shops. Yeah. You know, now it's in your supermarket. Right. We've got so many more toys to play with. It's wonderful.
Yeah, you wonder, and that's excellent to get your thoughts on that, too, just as the landscape has changed. Certainly there's more awareness about a lot of different things, but also for cooks, right?
Yeah.
They're not only just enjoying the cuisine out at restaurants that maybe they didn't have in the past, but now, yeah, they're trying to make the stuff as well.
Right. And then you go to farmers markets or elsewhere, and you're going to find all sorts of produce you didn't know about before as we become more and more of an international country. So, you know, you suddenly have to figure out what to do with these weird vegetables. And they're not weird. They're normal to somebody
else.
Because
there's a category. And it's like, that's in the weird section.
Yeah, right.
Well, when it comes to the television, of course, they can find all the different places at sarahmolton.com where they can see the program. But if in lieu of that, always you can have by your side the book, right? Let's talk a little bit about the book.
Yes. It's Home Cooking 101. The subtitle is How to Make Everything Taste Better. The subtitle could have been It's All in the Details. But I thought How to Make Everything Taste Better would grab people more. And it's very, very personal. It's about my almost 40 years in the industry. I started when I was 12. not. But at any rate. So I start out with all the most important things you need to know about cooking. And then I move on to all these recipes. There's 150 recipes, and they're almost all entrees. There's a side dish on a chapter on side dishes and a chapter on desserts. And I have 12 guest chefs. I'm trying to think if I have any. Oh, yeah, I have Rick Bayless making tacos, of course.
All right.
So typecast.
I know. Well, but he chooses to be.
I know.
You know, I mean, on the other hand, sometimes people say he's not Latin. Why is he doing this? But boy, has he studied it.
Yeah.
He knows what he's talking about.
And it would be weird if he just came in and made a burger or something like that.
Yeah,
no,
it'd be wrong.
It would be wrong. No, I think the taco is the best.
He's
best
such a lovely individual. Yeah. But at any rate, I have 12 guest chefs with, experience that I don't have. And then lots of how-tos, you know, and it's very, very quirky. My way to peel and devein shrimp, my way to butterfly a pork line, my way to separate eggs, a lot of things like that, and then more complicated things as well.
I'm excited for
this.
But
I think it's a good book for college students and newlyweds.
But even like someone like me who's been cooking forever, you know, sometimes I'm just like, I know I can do this better. I know that this, whatever I'm doing right here, how I'm like dicing this avocado is wrong.
Well, actually, it is wrong. It is wrong. That's one of the things I cover.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I worked with the California Avocado Board, and the way that we all open up, you know, cut up avocados has sent a lot of people to the emergency room. So they showed me a different way to do it.
Okay.
And that's in the book.
See?
Yeah. But then I you know, in the beginning, I have all about flavor and how to balance flavors and how to use salt, which is it's hands down the most important thing in cooking.
That's great.
And how to build umami and use your senses and not waste food and organize yourself and get a sharp knife, and it should be a 10-inch knife and all those sort of
things.
These
are things people really, they just need someone to say. Yeah. This is really the best way to do this.
Well, it's
instead
it's
of
the
having
best,
to yeah. kind of figure it out.
Well,
know?
It's I say so. You know, it's like you have to trust me. And
oh, it's great, and it's an honor, obviously, to have you here with us as well. Of course, the book is Home Cooking 101, and it'll be available at great bookstores ever. I'm sure on Amazon.com.
It is,
and maybe available on at SarahMoulton.com too.
No, isn't that dumb?
Well, I'm just
you just thought made me think of something, but no, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all the usual places. But yeah. And I'm very proud of it. I think it's my best book.
Well, I'm sure the people will be proud to have it and to be able to make things from it and kind of share that with their friends and family as well. Sarah, continued success and good luck in your travels. And thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Dane.
720 WGN, Dane Neal, Allstate Showcase Studio during the Nocturnal Journal. Dave Hoekstra on location. I hope he's not in the van the whole time. Maybe he's got, he mentioned he's kind of outfitted it with some technological advances. Maybe he's got a closed circuit feed to the stages in the van. Who knows? Hopefully he's getting in to enjoy a little bit of music. We'll be talking with him later on in the program. Sean Davis in the booth, and we were talking off the air, and on the food side of things, it's an exciting time. This is barbecue season. Recently, over the last couple of weeks, had Stephen Reichlin on. You remember him from Barbecue University, and of course he's written the Barbecue Bible. Whenever you've written the Bible, you know, whenever people are I don't want to say worshiping, right, but they're just parishioners for the good, I guess, religion of barbecue. We've had those people in. Chris Lilly's been in studio with us. Myron Mixon, the winningest man in barbecue, just ask him, will be on with us a little bit later. And he's opening up a brand new place in Wrigleyville or very close to it. Charlie McKenna was in studio talking about Rachel Ray's feedback. And so much is happening on the barbecue side. So as someone who loves barbecue, travels and covers some of the barbecue competitions and events, This is a good time. And during one of the breaks, Sean asked me, he's like, so, you know, what should I cook? What are you cooking? So I think it's one of those things, if it's not broke, don't fix it, in a lot of ways. You know, if like there's nothing wrong with steaks. It's not like they're inventing brand new awesome cuts of meat or whatever. But what is, like, Sean, so what do you do? And of course, listeners can, you know, text in or call in 312-981-7200 with their suggestions or what they're doing this weekend in the backyard. And hopefully we can share some of that with, if you've got a signature thing that you do or something that you grill or a way that you do it, we'd love to hear it. But Sean, so what are you guys going to be doing?
Well, it's an interesting thing for me because my wife is actually allergic to seafood.
Okay. Wow.
So all seafood?
All seafood.
Okay.
So I have multiple grills. Anything I cook for her must be on the Set Weber grill, the small one. She likes burgers, steaks, things of that nature. I myself, I'm into seafoods. We talked about that.
Right. The gumbo and, you know, a lot of the you know, that great stuff as far as the Cajun side. And,
absolutely. So yeah. I was asking you, like, what type of fish should I grill? Is there anything that's new and popping, as they say, on the grill scene? So that's what I'm looking forward to. I think I'm going to go to Mariano's tomorrow.
You know, and I was mentioning that if anybody has got any other suggestions, 312-981-7200 as far as, and Sean had asked, okay, so brisket, you know, if you're going to smoke something, it's a great thing to do, but obviously very time considerate, you know, or time consuming, and it takes a long time, and you have already had to start, you know, tonight in order to have it ready for tomorrow or overnight if you're going to do it. So it's not one of those things you can just decide spur of the moment you want to throw one on the smoker, on the grill. But so where are places that have it almost on demand and where it's not super expensive, because brisket can get pretty pricey, and we've got some great places, you know, some great Lily's Q Smoke, you've got, you know, and then there's so many other ones around the city and suburbs as far as great places on the restaurant side. But from a grocery store perspective, I actually think Mariano's is like pretty decent. It's maybe $12.99 a pound or something. You can go in there, you can decide you want brisket, you can head on in, you can get it, and you can be eating it 5 minutes later, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that as well. Any other ideas as far as recipes, like seasonings? I know a lot of people out there think about what type of seasoning should I do, marinate, brine, what should I do with my meat?
Well, on the chicken side, you should brine it. Yeah. That's kind of a thing that it was something that, you know, maybe a lot of people hadn't necessarily heard of a number of years ago, but it's the kind of thing you should always do right now. You know, chicken can get kind of dry on the grill, so it's always good to go ahead and brine that. And then find the flavors that you like. Some people love a little bit of heat. Some people love a little bit of sweet and some heat. I would just experiment, you know, on the rubs and figure out what you're going to do and what you're going to like. But you also make your own burgers. And this is, you know, Costco, you can get a big, like, string of burgers. They're not terrible. The Bubba burgers aren't terrible. Right. You know, they're okay. You can throw them on the grill. They're pretty good. But when you can make your own burger and throw in some of the stuff that you want to, whether, I know my wife throws in like a, you know, an egg and, you know, and a bunch of different things, onions, okay. You can build the cheese and the onions right into it. What do you do when you make your burgers?
I'd like to make it like I'm doing a baked potato. So I'll throw in like, mozzarella, feta, chives, sour cream. I'll do all of that type of stuff.
Wow.
Get different. Yeah.
Okay, so everybody in Chicagoland, everyone's going to be sitting around grilling in the backyard, enjoying it. When we come back from the news, we've got an interview, got a chance when I was out in Aspen to talk with Jacques, culinary legend Jacques Pepin. And you wonder, you know, he's, you know, French cuisine, obviously cooked for many, you know, the presidents of France and so many other people on the high fine dining side. You wonder if he's out there, you know, flipping burgers at some point, even at 80 plus years old. We'll see about that. We'll talk to him in just a second.
You know, the sharing of food may be the greatest of what civilization is, you know, sitting together and eating. You need to have more people sitting around the table, talking, speaking together and sharing food, you know, that's important. This is the Jacques Pepin with the Jacques Pepin Foundation in Aspen, and you're listening to WGN. Thank you.
720. WGN in Chicago. Dane Neal at the Aspen Cooking School, which is a great place to be. Aspen any time of the year, but when it's food and wine, classic time, it is a special time. It is also one of the times that thousands of fans, a select few, and of course we look forward to seeing the one and only Jacques Pepin in person. Do you know him from television so many decades, Emmy Award winning, James Beard Awards, and of course that position as one of the historical legends of the culinary world. And so it's exciting to have you with us, and of course to have you on the show today.
Well, I'm delighted. Delighted to be alive after all of this, you say. No, that's very nice of you. And I haven't been in Chicago in a little while, but I gave class there for years and years, and have many friends, like Jean-Jo and all that there, so already looking forward to go there.
You have friends everywhere, and for good reason, and to have you in Chicago with Jean-Jo at Everest is going to be great. And of course, we'll keep listeners apprised of that as you go forward. But so exciting, you know, people, of course, the history of doing the television, but live in person here with your fans, it has got to be energizing because you still amaze them with just how great you are at all the things that you do.
Well, yes. I mean, certainly, you know, I pass 80 years old now, so maybe there is less pressure. I mean, I cook with my granddaughter, I cook with my daughter today, and we're just having fun, period, and sharing a glass of wine. And, you know, that type of family structure, that type of binding that you get into the kitchen, dining room, is very important for us. So we do, and always right here, my son-in-law, so he's a chef too. So we bond with that too, you know. So.
I loved watching the presentation today. You guys look like you're having so much fun with Claudine. I mean, you know, just the happiness and the joy that you guys have in the kitchen together came through to everybody today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did five dish, right? Five, six dish in 45 minutes, and we had a great time. Simple dish that people can relate to and can do at home. So for us, this is, for me and Claudine too, this is the pleasure of cooking. I mean, we don't try to do, I may have in my career, quite a number of years ago, trying to do something extraordinary too. But now I don't have a restaurant, like a three-star extraordinary restaurant to puzzle you or whatever. So I do things that people can relate to, fresh, out of the market, having fun with it too. So that's the way we look at cooking.
This is an exciting day. It's always exciting to have you here. And you've always been giving to the people, whether it's the entertainment, whether it's the service that you've done, whether it's just providing, you know, the books and the television programs. But now to be in a historical moment with a historical figure, the start of the Jacques Pepin Foundation, and to have it be happening here, no better place than Aspen, and to have Raleigh involved as well. I mean, how excited are you to get this going?
I'm more than excited, and I really didn't do anything. It's really Rolly who's going to explain to you what it is. He knows much more, and he's done a fantastic job. I mean, doing this, he's great at that, and I'm very thankful. So tell them what it is, Rolly.
Well, first, you think of you as an entertainer, but of course, so much on the educational side, along with Rolly. And so you guys are going to focus on the educational side and supporting those students and people in the culinary world.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. And we're very excited to be starting the foundation and launching it here in Aspen. It's a great venue for it, as you said, Jacques, surrounded by his fans. And really, the foundation was born out of very close friends and family members coming together, first and foremost to honor the legacy of Jacques, but then also to give back. And, of course, Jacques's been giving back for decades. He's so generous. He's volunteered with all different kinds of nonprofits for decades, but we really wanted to take the opportunity to focus on what he thought was most important. And so what the foundation hopes to do is to really leverage culinary training to improve people's lives. And we have sort of a two-pronged approach. One is we're going to be a grant-making foundation. So for developing culinarians that want to extend their culinary training, they can come to us and apply for a grant, and we can provide money for them to go to Europe or to New York or to Chicago to work under a master, and so that they can really excel at their craft. And the other thing that we really want to do is help disenfranchised segments of society use culinary training to be reintegrated. So we're thinking about the homeless, we're thinking about veterans, we're thinking about previously incarcerated, and working with other nonprofits to help them with their culinary training to get people's foot in the door for a first position in a culinary kitchen.
With an emphasis on technique.
With an emphasis on technique, of course, yeah.
And that's been one of the kind of your hallmarks, right? Just the amazing way that you do things. And it's just like hockey. There's no substitute. You see it on TV, you see it in person, it's a whole different thing. But food is, and a culinary side, it is one of those transportational and transformational things. And so when you're trying to get back in the workforce, you know, food, it crosses all borders, and it is the kind of thing that if you're good at it, you can find work.
Yeah, we're talking about people, not only young people all excited to go in the greatest restaurant in the country. No, talking about 30, 40, 50 years old people who've been disenfranchised. They can reintegrate the world to be a cook somewhere. I mean, we're not talking about a three-star restaurant, but even if you have a little, you know, a little diner or a little restaurant in a corner, that gives you respect for yourself, for your family. To reintegrate the world like that, you can do a lot of good. And we want to start by showing them type of technique that I've done, because even if they know a little bit how to use their hand in that way, then they can work somewhere as a cook. So we're not talking about sending people to the great restaurants of the world. We're sending them to little restaurant, you know, in any part of any city where people will be happy to come and help, you know, where people will feel proud of themselves.
Yeah, and the thing about working in a restaurant, too, it is family a lot. You know, it really is very supportive. So someone that's disenfranchised and maybe needs to be brought into a community like that. And so it sounds like that is really what you're going to be doing, not only technique, but also kind of bringing them into the culinary community, the family that is a restaurant.
Right. There is a couple of organizations like that, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. We're not talking about reinventing the wheel here. We know that there's a lot of organizations, great organizations all across the country. There's a great one in Los Angeles, LA Kitchen. There's one in Seattle, Fair Start. I'm sure there's others in Chicago as well. We really want to partner with those organizations and see what expertise we can lend from the culinary technique side, from the education side. I teach culinary also at Johnson & Wales. I have a master's in education. So we really want to use technique, culinary training in order to do the most good that we possibly can.
It's great that you say that too, that you're not going to reinvent the wheel. You're going to just think outside the box a little bit and try to make those connections where you can to kind of just make those partnerships even stronger than they were before. So how can people find the foundation? How can people get involved, participate, and support what it is you guys are doing?
So they can find us on the web at jacquespepinfoundation.org. And because this is our soft opening launch, we actually have a special secret surprise on that website. If you type that in, jacquespepinfoundation.org, and /Aspen 2016, there's some gifts available for our inaugural donors, things that have never been available to the public before, original artworks by Jacques and some other things. So we would urge people to go and take a look at that, jacquespepinfoundation.org/Aspen 2016.
It is exciting times for you guys to be doing what you're doing. I know that you'll get a lot of support and participation for you. And of course, Jacques, and of course, Rolly, too. food has been your life. It has been your career in so many different ways. And you guys are thinking of ways that food can help improve their careers and change people's lives. And I wanted to get your thoughts a little bit. You know, as your career of working for three French heads of state, right? And then now, of course, you were with, you did a state dinner with the president here in the United States. And they've started the State Department Chef Corps with the whole thought process that food can be the link, food can be kind of the avenue to bring people together. Whatever differences we may have, we always can celebrate together with food.
You know, the sharing of food may be the greatest of what civilization is, you know, sitting together and eating. I mean, in 1824, Talleyrand was the Minister of France under Louis XVIII at the Congress of Vienna. The king told him, I'm going to give you more advice. I said, no, I need more cook. And all that, because this is the way, the deal and the discussion that are on the table. And when you see what has happened, you know, in Orlando last week, you need to have more people sitting around the table, talking, speaking together and sharing food. You know, that's important.
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing. Of course, we're going to thank you for starting the foundation, JacquesPepinFoundation.org. And Raleigh Wilson, thanks so much for being on the show as well.
2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 four-bit room. I'm a man of means by no
720 WGN, Dane Neal, Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. During the Nocturnal Journal, Dave Hoekstra is on location out at Fitzgerald's for the American Music Festival, the 35th year for that. He is on location and on the line. Dave, welcome back to your show.
We almost made it here, right? We all in one piece.
I don't know what kind
it's like
of
being in a, like being in a spaceship.
I'm not sure. You know, when it first got described, it was like, it's going to be fun. Number one, it's going to be exciting, but you know, you want to survive. And I'm not sure what kind of chaos is happening out there at Fitzgerald's. Are you all in one piece?
Yeah, we're doing okay. We got Billy Prine. We're talking to him now. John's brother. He's talking about he played open for Chris Christopherson at Summerfest, so he's enjoying the van. And Dan's holding up all right. So it's been a good 2 hours.
He's enjoying the van. So again, yeah. For the listeners just checking in, and the audience changes on occasion. But the so describe the inner workings of the van. Have you set it up in regular interview style? Are you at a desk like Johnny Carson, and then everyone next to you in chairs?
Pictures. That's what I'm most proud of. I actually had a hand in designing this. So I'm at a desk, and there's a chair. And then we have a guest who sits in another chair, looks right at me. Dan is he's on my bed. There's a bed in the back, and so Dan's taking care of that. He's right by the refrigerator. We got a refrigerator that's working all right. There's a microwave I have yet to use, but there isn't. I don't want to blow any more fuses, so I'm scared to use the microwave. And then there's two chairs, and you know, passenger and driver's seat in the front. We got a little TV and a DVD player, so it's a nice setup. You know, we got little blue lights. What's really exciting, you should have been out here, is we've put out the we've got a little porch. What do you call that? Like, what would you call that? Like a extension deck. Yeah, like a little light thing that we put over, like a veranda. So people are sitting outside in lawn chairs and stuff. So it's nice. It's a nice setup.
You have your van has a veranda. It has a porch.
Yeah. Well, it's like an awning, that's the word I'm looking for, yeah. I'm pretty wiped out from all this. But yeah, it's like an awning, and it lights up. It's like got like a little blue lights on it. So, you know what I'm really excited about? This was a hectic 3 weeks, and I was like camping every other night, you know, and I was, you know, I mean, it's just like moving from campground to campground to campground. I spent 2 nights in Idaho. That was good. But I wanted to take this thing out to like Starved Rock or over to Michigan and stuff by the dunes and just spend 2 or 3 nights in it and open up veranda thing and just drink beer and just relax in it. I think that'll be a real fun thing to do. I've been working pretty hard on this. You know?
That's so. Right. It's Miller time. I mean, it's time for you to sit back, relax and enjoy. And of course, Dan Long doing such a great job with your show on a regular basis, week to week. But is he like in his capacity now, is he actually helping out? Is he handing out the Nocturnal Journal coffee mugs for the guests to be able to sip during the interview?
Yeah, Dan's been great. Dan's been really good. And, I mean, the segments we're coming back with, they're really outstanding. You know, and I'm finding in a way, it's like Dan and I were talking, the interviews are really interesting in this thing. I mean, it's like you're a little closer to people. There's no walls between you and not a lot of space. And so we're getting some good stuff. Curtis McMurtry did a couple really nice acoustic songs. And when I had this thing designed, I had it designed purposely for interviews and for music and stuff. So we've got some insulation on the wall. So Dan, I think it sounds okay, right? Yeah. So we're real happy with the product.
So for your fans and you know, you're there kind of curating new material that you're going to be showcasing on the show next week. Let's run down the things that people are going to enjoy hearing next Saturday night.
Curtis McMurtry. He came on, and he's the son of James McMurtry, grandson of Larry McMurtry, Lonesome Dove. Just really fascinating interview. You know, he does some really interesting things with chamber music in a singer-songwriter type style, but he also tries to bring some strings and horns, and the way he uses that stuff is really unique. He had some great insight into songwriting. Billy Prine, he talked about working with Fred Kohler, who we know. You know, from Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
And bookstores. You know, Fred Kohler runs a bookstore in Nashville, as Larry McMurtry did. So he was great. I'd never talked to Curtis before. We're going to have Billy Prine. Billy Prine's going to be talking about his career in Nashville and in Chicago. And then John D. Graham. He just a longtime Austin singer-songwriter, kind of mentored Curtis McMurtry. So he did some good stuff, too. So it'll be some good stuff for next. Down the road.
Oh, it sounds like it's going to be awesome for listeners, for fans of the Nocturnal Journal to be able to enjoy this night kind of vicariously through you as you ask those questions. And for the van itself, you mentioned heading out to Starved Rock, maybe the dunes. You could fit some people. You have a veranda after all. Is there any thought to maybe doing a listener contest and maybe bringing a listener or two with you in the camper?
That's a great idea. Bringing a listener with us, Dan. Yeah.
I mean, you'll have to vet them for mental stability and safety first, of course. Because
yeah, we've got some trips. And for the book, I've got some stuff planned. I really want to, I've been to it before, and I wrote about the butter cow for the Sun-Times, but I really want to embed the van in the Iowa State Fair. You know, they've got a whole camping village there, and I think some of them are just campers, and some of them might be, you know, carnival workers and stuff. So I'm really excited about doing that. So I want to take the van to Iowa in August. And there's a whole thing called glamping of women who do this stuff, and they decorate their vans and they go all retro and they got, yeah, they call it glampers, GLAMPER. I got a glamper book up here anyway.
It implies is I'm imagining that the entire camper would be bedazzled. Is that what it is?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I didn't know about this until I started researching it. I'm looking for the book, but yeah, it's called glamping, and a lot of them they take these, like, not really so much camper vans, although they do that, but they take the little trailers or the teardrop trailers that you pull along and stuff, and they just decorate them in like real retro style. And I think there's one having like a glamper type convention over in the Cleveland area in early August. I got to go back to the RV Hall of Fame. That's where I started. I started all this in January. You know, I did some research there. This thing was tricked out in Elkhart, where 85% of the RVs are made. So I want to go camping over by the RV Hall of Fame. I think that'd be fun.
Insight into different and completely unique segments of the population. I was unaware at this point, even at my advanced age, that there was an RV Hall of Fame. Is there, like, you know, kind of revered, campers and
oh yeah, it's great. You gotta go. It's really you can go with me next time I get this repaired. I've been going there a lot to get some fine tuning, but they've got like a little trailer that Charles Lindbergh had made that kind of influenced the spirit of St. Louis. They got a little train, the train car that Mae West used and stuff. So they got antique and historic RVs and campers and stuff, but they've got a great research room that I really want to spend some time in. They got a gift shop. I bought some camper and RV art. They've been on the show. So yeah, it's a great destination, but I think it would be really fun to camp as close to the RV Hall of Fame as possible.
Is there, like, you know, like Claude Winnebago, the guy who started it all, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there is stuff like that. Yeah, they have all that. Yeah, it's really cool. They have somebody who, I don't want to give the whole book away, but I got to get to the bottom of this. There's somebody who designed it, never got off the ground, but of course he was from Wisconsin, and he designed picture Marina City. And he wanted to do a thing. This is in the 60s. Picture Marina City. And he had all trailers and RVs going up like you do at Marina City. So it was a place you could live in your trailers and stuff, but it was all going up in the air. It was like an aerial mobile home park.
like a high-rise parking garage, but filled
filled with RVs and motorhomes. Really crazy.
Before we let you go, let's talk a little bit about the camper book that you're doing. Like, what's how do you kind of mentally get ready to do something like that? What's the time frame for doing it? And then a lot of the things that you're that you're sharing, you know, there's just so many great visuals that I'm thinking, is it going to be like a coffee table book? Like, how are you going to do it?
It's going to be about 60,000 words. John Saul, who I work with sometimes, he's taking a lot of the pictures and stuff. I think it's going to be paperback. People can carry it around with us and stuff. There'll be a lot of photos. Kind of like the stories of people who are doing this. I mean, the other books I've done, sometimes the interviews were kind of challenging and stuff, but here, I mean, it's interesting because people are off the grid in this book for all kinds of different reasons, whether it's personal reasons, spiritual reasons. I mean, there's people who are doing this are really doing something different with their lives and stuff. So it's going to be already. I mean, I found so much content on this 3-week trip, and there's a lot more traveling to do and stuff. So the book will be out March 2018 on the Chicago Review Press.
And you're implying that so many people are kind of traveling like this for a variety of reasons. You're kind of implying that maybe the names in the book will be changed to project the fugitives, that there could be some people on the run.
I just like people, you know, again, based on a small sample size so far, I mean, I just like people who take chances and try to do something different with their lives. And sometimes you have to be brave to do that. And I think that's one thing I've learned from these 3 weeks. You know, people have made some interesting decisions with their life, and you know what? They're pretty happy about it.
It is great stuff, and I'm sure your fans are enjoying the show tonight. They're going to enjoy the interviews that you're getting right now, that you're going to play next week. And for people who want to catch up with you that may not be as familiar, do you have social media or website that you want to share before we let you get back to the music?
Yeah, they tell me to go to DaveHoekstra.com. I'm always bad about doing this on the show. And there's also the camper book. There is a Facebook page that people participated in. You know, we tried to spread that around when we were out on the road and stuff. So the camper book on Facebook and DaveHoekstra.com.
Camper book on Facebook.
I had to look at a card to tell you that.
Right. I'm imagining in my mind, like, Dan holding up kind of cue cards or running the teleprompter.
I'm really bad on self-promoting. There's also a Twitter thing, you know, for the camper book. I think we've got, like, 7 followers. I shouldn't say that. But, yeah. But DaveHoekstra.com and the camper book is how they can find us.
Great stuff. Great stuff that you're doing. Enjoy the rest of your night, as I'm sure all the people there with you will enjoy it as well. And, Dave, thanks so much for being on your show tonight.
Well, thanks for helping us out.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. All right, Dave Hoekstra, it is the Nocturnal Journal. We're going to take a quick break before we come back and wrap it all up. It's Dane in for Dave on 720 WGN.